31. Near winter passed. Ellie's faith in Santa Claus was restored, temporarily at least, by the footprints in the hearth. Gage opened his presents splendidly, pausing every now and then to munch a particularly tasty-looking piece of wrapping paper. And that year both kids had decided by mid-afternoon that the boxes were more fun than the toys. The Crandalls came over on New Year's Eve for Rachel's eggnog, and Lewis found himself mentally examining Norma. She had a pale and somehow transparent look that he had seen before. His grandmother would have said Norma was beginning to fail, and that was perhaps not such a bad word for it. All at once her hands, so swollen and misshapen by arthritis, seemed covered with liver spots. Her hair looked thinner. The Crandalls went home around 10, and the Creeds saw the New Year in together in front of the TV. It was the last time Norma was in their house. Most of Lewis's semester break was sloppy and rainy. In terms of heating costs, he was grateful for the thaw, but the weather was still depressing and dismal. He worked around the house, building bookshelves and cupboards for his wife and a model Porsche in his study for himself. By the time classes resumed on January 23rd, Lewis was happy to go back to the university. The flu finally arrived. A fairly serious outbreak struck the campus less than a week after the spring semester had begun, and he had his hands full. He found himself working 10 and sometimes 12 hours a day and going home utterly whipped, but not really unhappy. The warm spell broke on January 29th with a roar. There was a blizzard, followed by a week of numbing sub-zero weather. Lewis was checking the mending broken arm of a young man who was hoping desperately, and fruitlessly in Lewis's opinion, that he would be able to play baseball that spring, when one of the candy stripers poked her head in and told him his wife was on the telephone. Lewis went into his office to take the call. Rachel was crying, and he was instantly alarmed. Ellie, he thought, she's fallen off her sled and broken her arm, or fractured her skull. He thought with alarm of the crazed fraternity boys and their toboggan. It isn't one of the kids, is it? He asked. Rachel? No, she said, crying harder. Not one of the kids. It's Norma Lou. Norma Crandall. She died this morning. Around 8 o'clock, right after breakfast, Judd said. He came over to see if you were here, and I told him you'd left half an hour ago. He just seemed so lost and so dazed, so old. Thank God Ellie was gone, and Gage is too young to understand. Lewis's brow furrowed, and in spite of this terrible news, he found it was Rachel his mind was going out to, seeking, trying to find. Because here it was again. Nothing you could quite put your finger on, because it was so much an overall attitudinal fix. That death was a secret, a terror, and it was to be kept from the children. Above all, to be kept from the children. The way that Victorian ladies and gentlemen had believed the nasty, grotty truth about sexual relations must be kept from the children. Jesus, he said. Was it her heart? I don't know, she said. She was no longer crying, but her voice was choked and hoarse. Could you come, Lewis? You're his friend, and I think he needs you. You're his friend. Well, I am, Lewis thought, with a small touch of surprise. I never expected to have an 80-year-old man for a buddy, but I guess I do. And then it occurred to him that they had better be friends, considering what was between them. And considering that, he supposed that Judd had known they were friends long before Lewis had. Judd had stood by him on that one, and in spite of what had happened since, in spite of the mice, in spite of the birds, Lewis felt that Judd's decision had probably been the right one, or, if not the right one, at least the compassionate one. He would do what he could for Judd now, and if it meant being best man at the death of his wife, he would be that. On my way, he said, and hung up. 32. It had not been a heart attack. It had been a cerebral accident, sudden and probably painless. When Lewis called Steve Masterton that afternoon and told him what was going on, Steve said that he wouldn't mind going out just that way. Sometimes God dillies and dallies, Steve said, and sometimes he just points at you and tells you to hang up your jock. Rachel did not want to talk about it at all, and would not allow Lewis to talk to her of it. Ellie was not so much upset as she was surprised and interested. It was what Lewis thought a thoroughly healthy 6-year-old reaction should be. She wanted to know if Mrs. Crandall had died with her eyes shut or open. Lewis said he didn't know. Judd took hold as well as could have been expected, considering the fact that the lady had been sharing bed and board with him for almost 60 years. Lewis found the old man, and on this day he looked very much like an old man of 83, sitting alone at the kitchen table, smoking a Chesterfield, drinking a bottle of beer, and staring blankly into the living room. He looked up when Lewis came in and said, "Well, she's gone, Lewis." He said this in such a clear and matter-of-fact way that Lewis thought it must not have really cleared through all the circuits yet, hadn't hit him yet where he lived. Then Judd's mouth began to work, and he covered his eyes with one arm. Lewis went to him and put an arm around him. Judd gave in and wept. It had cleared the circuits all right. Judd understood perfectly. His wife had died. "That's good," Lewis said. "That's good, Judd. She would want you to cry a little, I think. Probably be pissed off if you didn't." He had started to cry a little himself. Judd hugged him tightly, and Lewis hugged him back. Judd cried for 10 minutes or so, and then the storm passed. Lewis listened to the things Judd said then with great care. He listened as a doctor as well as a friend. He listened for any circularity in Judd's conversation. He listened to see if Judd's grasp of when was clear. No need to check him on where. That would prove nothing, because for Judd Crandall, the where had always been Ludlow, Maine. He listened most of all for any use of Norma's name in the present tense. He found little or no sign that Judd was losing his grip. Lewis was aware that it was not uncommon for two old married people to go almost hand in hand, a month, a week, even a day apart. The shock, he supposed, or maybe even some deep inner urge to catch up with the one gone. That was a thought he would not have had before church. He found that many of his thoughts concerning the spiritual and the supernatural had undergone a quiet but nonetheless deep sea change. His conclusion was that Judd was grieving hard, but that he was still compos mentis. He sensed in Judd none of that transparent frailty that had seemed to surround Norma on New Year's Eve, when the four of them had sat in the Creed living room drinking eggnog. Judd brought a beer from the fridge, his face still red and blotchy from crying. "A bit early in the day," he said, "but the sun's over the Yardarm somewhere in the world, and under the circumstances..." "Say no more," Lewis told him and opened the beer. He looked at Judd. "Shall we drink to her?"
"I guess we better," Judd said. "You should have seen her when she was 16, Lewis. Coming back from church with her jacket unbuttoned. Your eyes would have popped. She could have made the devil swear off drinking. Thank Christ she never asked me to do it."
Lewis nodded and raised his beer a little. "To Norma," he said. Judd clinked his bottle against Lewis's. He was crying again, but he was also smiling. He nodded.
"May she have peace, and let there be no frigging arthritis wherever she is."
"Amen," Lewis said, and they drank. It was the only time Lewis saw Judd progress beyond a mild tipsiness, and even so he did not become incapacitated. He reminisced, a constant stream of warm memories and anecdotes, colorful and clear and sometimes arresting, flowed from him. Yet between the stories of the past, Judd dealt with the present in a way Lewis could only admire. If it had been Rachel, who had simply dropped dead after her grapefruit and morning cereal, he wondered if he could have done half so well. Judd called the Brookings Smith Mortuary in Bangor and made as many of the arrangements as he could by telephone. He made an appointment to come in the following day and make the rest. Yes, he would have her embalmed. He wanted her in a dress, which he would provide. Yes, he would pick out underwear. No, he did not want the mortuary to supply the special shoes which laced up the back. "Would they have someone wash her hair?" he asked. "She washed it last on Monday night, so it had been dirty when she died." He listened, and Lewis, whose uncle had been in what those in the business called the quiet trade, knew the undertaker was telling Judd that a final wash and set was part of the service rendered. Judd nodded and thanked the man he was talking to, then listened again. Yes, he said, he would have her cosmeticized, but it was to be a lightly applied layer.
"She's dead, and people know it," he said, lighting a Chesterfield. No need to tie her up. The coffin would be closed during the funeral, he told the director with calm authority, but open during the visiting hours the day before. She was to be buried in Mount Hope Cemetery, where they had bought plots in 1951. He had the papers in hand and gave the mortician the plot number so that preparations could begin out there. H-101. He himself had H-102, he told Lewis later on. He hung up, looked at Lewis, and said, "Prettiest cemetery in the world is right here in Bangor, as far as I'm concerned. Crack yourself another beer if you want, Lewis. All of this is going to take a while." Lewis was about to refuse. He was feeling a little tiddly when a grotesque image arose unbidden behind his eyes. Judd pulling Norma's corpse on a pagan litter through the woods toward the Micmac burying ground beyond the pet cemetery. It had the effect of a slap on him. Without a word, he got up and got another beer out of the fridge. Judd nodded at him and dialed the telephone again. By 3 that afternoon, when Lewis went home for a sandwich and a bowl of soup, Judd had progressed a long way toward organizing his wife's final rites. He moved from one thing to the next like a man planning a dinner party of some importance. He called the North Ludlow Methodist Church, where the actual funeral would take place, and the cemetery administration office at Mount Hope. These were both calls the undertaker at Brookings Smith would be making, but Judd called first as a courtesy. It was a step few bereaved ever thought of, or if they thought of it, one they could rarely bring themselves to take. Lewis admired Judd all the more for it. Later he called Norma's few surviving relatives, and his own, paging through an old and tattered address book with a leather cover to find the numbers. In between calls, he drank beer and remembered the past. Lewis felt great admiration for him. And love? Yes, his heart confirmed. And love. When Ellie came down that night in her pajamas to be kissed, she asked Lewis if Mrs. Crandall would go to heaven. She almost whispered the question to Lewis, as if she understood it would be better if they were not overheard. Rachel was in the kitchen making a chicken pie, which she intended to take over to Judd the next day. Across the street, all the lights were on in the Crandall house. Cars were parked in Judd's driveway and up and down the shoulder of the highway on that side for 100 feet in either direction. The official viewing hours would be tomorrow at the mortuary, but tonight people had come to comfort Judd as well as they could and to help him remember and to celebrate Norma's passing, what Judd had referred to once that afternoon as the foregoing. Between that house and this, a frigid February wind blew. The road was patched with black ice. The coldest part of the main winter was now upon them. "Well, I don't really know, honey," Lewis said, taking Ellie on his lap. On the TV, a running gunfight was in progress. A man spun and dropped, unremarked upon by either of them. Lewis was aware, uncomfortably so, that Ellie probably knew a hell of a lot more about Ronald McDonald and Spider-Man and the Burger King than she did about Moses, Jesus, and St. Paul. She was the daughter of a one who was a non-practicing Jew and a man who was a lapsed Methodist, and he supposed her ideas about the whole Spiritus Mundi were of the vaguest sort. Not myths, not dreams, but dreams of dreams. "It's late for that," he thought randomly. "She's only 5. But it's late for that. Jesus Christ, it gets late so fast." But Ellie was looking at him, and he ought to say something. "People believe all sorts of things about what happens to us when we die," he said. "Some people think we go to heaven or hell. Some people believe we're born again as little children. Sure, carnation. Like what happened to Audrey Rose in that movie on TV. You never saw that." Rachel, he thought, would have her own cerebral accident if she thought Ellie had seen Audrey Rose. "Marie told me at school," Ellie said. Marie was Ellie's self-proclaimed best friend, a malnourished, dirty little girl who always looked as if she might be on the edge of impetigo or ringworm or perhaps even scurvy. Both Lewis and Rachel encouraged the friendship as well as they could, but Rachel had once confessed to Lewis that after Marie left, she always felt an urge to check Ellie's head for nits and head lice. Lewis had laughed and nodded. "Marie's mommy lets her watch all the shows." There was an implied criticism in this that Lewis chose to ignore. Well, it's reincarnation, but I guess you've got the idea. The Catholics believe in heaven and hell, but they also believe there's a place called limbo and one called purgatory. And the Hindus and Buddhists believe in nirvana. There was a shadow on the dining room wall. Rachel, listening. Lewis went on more slowly. There are probably lots more, too. But what it comes down to, Ellie, is this. No one knows. People say they know. But when they say that, what they mean is that they believe because of faith. Do you know what faith is? Well, here we are, sitting in my chair, Lewis said. Do you think my chair will still be here tomorrow? Yeah, sure. Then you have faith it will be here. As it so happens, I do too. Faith is believing a thing will be, or is. Get it? Yes, Ellie nodded positively. But we don't know it'll be here. After all, some crazed chair burglar might break in and take it, right? Ellie giggled. Lewis smiled. We just have faith that won't happen. Faith is a great thing, and really religious people would like us to believe that faith and knowing are the same thing. But I don't believe that myself, because there are too many different ideas on the subject. What we know is this. When we die, one of two things happens. Either our souls and thoughts somehow survive the experience of dying, or they don't. If they do, that opens up every possibility you could think of. If we don't, it's just blotto. The end. Like going to sleep? He considered this, and then said, more like having ether, I think. Which do you have faith in, Daddy? The shadow on the wall moved and came to rest again. For most of his adult life, since college days, he supposed, he had believed that death was the end. He had been present at many deathbeds, and had never felt a soul bullet past him on its way to wherever. Hadn't this very thought occurred to him upon the death of Victor Pascal? He'd agreed with his Psychology I teacher that the life-after-life experiences reported in scholarly journals and then vulgarized in the popular press probably indicated a last-ditch mental stand against the onrush of death, the endlessly inventive human mind staving off insanity to the very end by constructing a hallucination of immortality. He had likewise agreed with an acquaintance in the dorm who had said during an all-night bull session during Lewis's sophomore year at Chicago that the Bible was suspiciously full of miracles which had ceased almost completely during the age of rationality. Totally ceased, he had said at first, but had been forced backward at least one step by others who claimed with some authority that there were still plenty of weird things going on, little pockets of perplexity in a world that had become, by and large, a clean, well-lighted place. There was, for instance, the Shroud of Turin, which had survived every effort to debunk it. So Christ brought Lazarus back from the dead, this acquaintance, who had gone on to become a highly thought-of OB man in Dearborn, Michigan, had said, that's fine with me. If I have to swallow it, I will. I mean, I had to buy the concept that the fetus of one twin can sometimes swallow the fetus of another in utero, like some kind of unborn cannibal, and then show up with teeth in his testes or in his lungs 20 or 30 years later to prove that he did it. And I suppose if I can buy that, I can buy anything. But I want to see the death certificate. You dig what I'm saying? I'm not questioning that he came out of the tomb, but I want to see the original death certificate. I'm like Thomas saying he'd only believe Jesus had risen when he could look through the nail holes and stick his hands in the guy's side. As far as I'm concerned, he was the real physician of the bunch, not Luke. No, he had never really believed in survival, at least not until church. I believe that we go on, he told his daughter slowly. But as to what it's like, I have no opinion. It may be that it's different for different people. It may be that you get what you believed all your life. But I believe we go on. And I believe that Mrs. Crandall is probably some place where she can be happy. You have faith in that, Ellie said. It was not a question. She sounded awed. Lewis smiled, a little pleased and a little embarrassed.
I suppose so.
And I have faith that it's time for you to go to bed, like 10 minutes ago. He kissed her twice, once on the lips and once on the nose.
Do you think animals go on?
Yes, he said, without thinking, and for a moment he almost added, especially cats. The words had actually trembled on his lips for a moment, and his skin felt gray and cold.
Okay,
she said and slid down. Gotta go kiss Mommy.
Right on.
He watched her go. At the dining room doorway, she turned back and said, I was really silly about church that day, wasn't I, crying like that?
No, hon, he said. I don't think you were silly.
If he died now, I could take it, she said, and then seemed to consider the thought she had just spoken aloud, as if mildly startled. Then she said, as if agreeing with herself, sure I could, and went to find Rachel. Later, in bed, Rachel said, I heard what you were talking about.
And you don't approve? Lewis asked.
He had decided that maybe it would be best to have this out, if that was what Rachel wanted.
No,
Rachel said, with a hesitance that was not much like her.
No, Lewis, it's not like that. I just get scared. And do you know me? When I get scared, I get defensive.
Lewis could not remember ever hearing Rachel speak with such effort, and suddenly he felt more cautious than he had with Ellie earlier. He felt that he was in a minefield.
Scared of what? Dying?
Not myself, she said. I hardly even think of that anymore. But when I was a kid, I thought of it a lot. Lost a lot of sleep. Dreamed of monsters coming to eat me up in my bed. And all of the monsters looked like my sister Zelda.
Yes, Lewis thought. Here it is. At last, after all the time we've been married, here it is.
You don't talk about her much, he said.
Rachel smiled and touched his face. You're sweet, Lewis. I never talk about her. I try never to think about her.
I always assumed you had your reasons.
I did. I do.
She paused, thinking.
I know she died.
Spinal meningitis. Spinal meningitis, she repeated. There are no pictures of her in the house anymore.
There's a picture of a young girl in your father's...
In his study. Yes, I forgot that one. And my mother carries one in her wallet still, I think. She was 2 years older than I was. She caught it, and she was in the back bedroom. She was in the back bedroom like a dirty secret, Lewis. She was dying in there. My sister died in the back bedroom. And that's what she was, a dirty secret. She was always a dirty secret.
Rachel suddenly broke down completely, and in the loud, rising quality of her sobs, Lewis sensed the onset of hysteria and became alarmed. He reached for her and caught a shoulder, which was pulled away from him as soon as he touched it. He could feel the whisper of her nightdress under his fingertips.
Rachel, babe, don't.
Don't tell me, don't, she said. Don't stop me, Lewis. I've only got the strength to tell this once, and then I don't want to ever talk about it again. I probably won't sleep tonight as it is.
Was it that horrible? He asked, knowing the answer already.
It explained so much, and even things he had never connected before, or only suspected vaguely, suddenly came together in his mind. She had never attended a funeral with him, he realized. Not even that of Al Locke, a fellow med student who had been killed when his motorcycle had collided with a city bus. Al had been a regular visitor at their apartment, and Rachel had always liked him. Yet she had not gone to his funeral.
She was sick that day, Lewis remembered suddenly. Got the flu or something. Looked serious. But the next day she was okay again.
After the funeral she was all right again, he corrected himself.
He remembered thinking, even then, that her sickness might just be psychosomatic. It was horrible, all right. Worse than you can ever imagine.
Lewis, we watched her degenerate day by day, and there was nothing anyone could do. She was in constant pain. Her body seemed to shrivel, pull in on itself. Her shoulders hunched up, and her face pulled down until it was like a mask.
Her hands were like bird's feet. I had to feed her sometimes. I hated it, but I did it, and never said boo about it. When the pain got bad enough, they started giving her drugs, mild ones at first, and then ones that would have left her a junkie if she had lived. But, of course, everyone knew she wasn't going to live. I guess that's why she's such a secret to all of us. Because we wanted her to die, Lewis. We wished for her to die. And it wasn't just so she wouldn't feel any more pain. It was so we wouldn't feel any more pain. It was because she was starting to look like a monster. And she was starting to be a monster. Oh, Christ, I know how awful that must sound. She put her face in her hands. Lewis touched her gently. Rachel, it doesn't sound awful at all. It does, she cried. It does. It just sounds true, he said. Victims of long illnesses often become demanding, unpleasant monsters. The idea of the saint-like, long-suffering patient is a big romantic fiction. By the time the first set of sores crops up on a bed-bound patient's butt, he or she has started to snipe and cut and spread the misery. They can't help it, but that doesn't help the people in the situation. She looked at him amazed, almost hopeful. Then distrust stole back into her face. You're making that up. He smiled grimly. Want me to show you the textbooks? How about the suicide statistics? Want to see those? In families where a terminal patient has been nursed at home, the suicide statistics spike right up into the stratosphere in the 6 months following the patient's death. Suicide! They swallow pills or sniff a pipe or blow their brains out. Their hate, their weariness, their disgust, their sorrow. He shrugged and brought his closed fists gently together. The survivors start feeling as if they'd committed murder. So they step out. A crazy, wounded kind of relief had crept into Rachel's puffy face. She was demanding, hateful. Sometimes she'd piss in her bed deliberately. My mother would ask her if she wanted help getting to the bathroom. And later, when she couldn't get up anymore, if she wanted the bedpan, and Zelda would say no. And then she'd piss the bed so my mother and I would have to change the sheets. And she'd say it was an accident, but you could see the smile in her eyes, Lewis. You could see it. The room always smelled of piss and her drugs. She had bottles of some dope that smelled like Smith Brothers Wild Cherry cough drops. And that smell was always there. Some nights I wake up. Even now I wake up and I think I can smell Wild Cherry cough drops. And I think, if I'm not really awake, I think, is Zelda dead yet? Is she? I think... Rachel caught her breath. Lois took her hand and she squeezed his fingers with savage, brilliant tightness. When we changed her, you could see the way her back was twisting and knotting. Near the end, Lois, near the end, it seemed like her ass had somehow gotten all the way up to the middle of her back. Now Rachel's wet eyes had taken on the glassy, horrified look of a child remembering a recurrent nightmare of terrible power. And sometimes she'd touch me with her hands, her birdie hands, and sometimes I'd almost scream and ask her not to. And once I spilled some of her soup on my arm when she touched my face, and I burned myself. And that time I did scream. I cried, and I could see the smile in her eyes then, too. Near the end, the drugs stopped working. She was the one who would scream then, and none of us could remember the way she was before, not even my mother. She was just this foul, hateful, screaming thing in the back bedroom, our dirty secret. Rachel swallowed. Her throat clicked. My parents were gone when she finally... When she... With terrible, wrenching effort, Rachel brought it out. When she died, my parents were gone. They were gone, but I was with her. It was Passover season, and they went out for a while to see some friends. Just for a few minutes. I was reading a magazine in the kitchen. Well, I was looking at it anyway. I was waiting for it to be time to give her some more medicine because she was screaming. She'd been screaming ever since my folks left, almost. I couldn't read with her screaming that way. And then, see, what happened was, well,
Zelda stopped screaming. Louis, I was 8. Bad dreams every night. I had started to think she hated me because my back was straight, because I didn't have the constant pain, because I could walk, because I was going to live. I started to imagine she wanted to kill me. Only, even now, tonight, Louis, I don't really think it was all my imagination. I do think she hated me. I don't really think she would have killed me. But if she could have taken over my body some way, turned me out of it like in a fairy story, I think she would have done that. But when she stopped screaming, I went in to see if everything was all right, to see if she had fallen over on her side or slipped off her pillows. I got in and I looked at her and I thought she must have swallowed her own tongue and she was choking to death. Louis! Rachel's voice rose again, teary and frighteningly childish, as if she were regressing, reliving the experience. Louis, I didn't know what to do. I was 8. No, of course you didn't, Louis said. He turned to her and hugged her, and Rachel gripped him with the panicky strength of a poor swimmer whose boat has suddenly overturned in the middle of a large lake. Did someone actually give you a hard time about it, babe? No, she said. No one blamed me. But nobody could make it better either. No one could change it. No one could make it an unhappening, Louis. She hadn't swallowed her tongue. She started making a sound, a kind of, I don't know, gah, like that. In her distressed total recall of that day, she did a more than creditable imitation of the way her sister Zelda must have sounded. And Louis's mind flashed to Victor Pascal. His grip on his wife tightened. And there was spit coming down her chin. Rachel, that's enough, he said, not quite steadily. I am aware of the symptoms. I'm explaining, she said stubbornly. I'm explaining why I can't go to poor Norma's funeral, for one thing, and why we had that stupid fight that day. Shh, that's forgotten. Not by me, it isn't, she said. I remember it well, Louis. I remember it as well as I remember my sister Zelda choking to death in her bed on April 14th, 1965. For a long moment, there was silence in the room. I turned her over on her belly and thumped her back, Rachel went on at last. It's all I knew to do. Her feet were beating up and down, and her twisted legs, and I remember there was a sound like farting. I thought she was farting, or I was, but it wasn't farts. It was the seams under both arms of my blouse ripping out when I turned her over. She started to convulse, and I saw that her face was turned sideways, turned into the pillows, and I thought, oh, she's choking, Zelda's choking, and they'll come home and say I murdered her by choking. They'll say, you hated her, Rachel, and that was true. And they'll say, you wanted her to be dead, and that was true, too. Because, Louis, see, the first thought that went through my mind when she started to go up and down in the bed like that, I remember it, my first thought was, oh, good, finally. Zelda's choking, and this is going to be over. So I turned her over again, and her face had gone black, Louis, and her eyes were bulging, and her neck was swelled up. Then she died. I backed across the room. I guess I wanted to back out the door, but I hit the wall, and a picture fell down. It was a picture from one of the Oz books that Zelda liked before she got sick with the meningitis, when she was well. It was a picture of Oz the Great and Terrible. Only Zelda always called him Oz the Great and Terrible because she couldn't make that sound. And so she sounded like Elmer Fudd. My mother got that picture framed because Zelda liked it most of all. Oz the Great and Terrible. And it fell down and hit the floor and the glass and the frame shattered and I started to scream because I knew she was dead and I thought it was her ghost coming back to get me. And I knew that her ghost would hate me like she did. But her ghost wouldn't be stuck in bed, so I screamed. I screamed, and I ran out of the house screaming, Zelda's dead! Zelda's dead! Zelda's dead! And the neighbors, they came and they looked. They saw me running down the street with my blouse all ripped out under the arms. I was yelling, Zelda's dead, Louis. And I guess maybe they thought I was crying. But I think maybe I was laughing, Lewis. I think maybe that's what I was doing.
If you were, I salute you for it, Lewis said. You don't mean that, though, Rachel said with the utter surety of one who has been over a point, and over it, and over it. He let it go. He thought she might eventually get rid of this awful, rancid memory that had haunted her for so long. Most of it, anyway. But never this part. Never completely. Lewis Creed was no psychiatrist, but he knew that there are rusty, half-buried things in the terrain of any life, and that human beings seem compelled to go back to these things and pull at them, even though they cut. Tonight, Rachel had pulled almost all of it out, like some grotesque and stinking rotten tooth, its crown black, its nerves infected, its roots fetid. It was out. Let that last noxious cell remain. If God was good, it would remain dormant except in her deepest dreams. That she'd been able to remove as much as she had was well nigh incredible. It did not just speak of her courage. It clarioned it. Lewis was in awe of her. He felt like cheering. He sat up now and turned on the light. Yes, he said. I salute you for it. And if I needed another reason to really dislike your mother and father, I've got it now. You never should have been left alone with her, Rachel. Never. Like a child, the child of 8 she had been when this dirty, incredible thing had happened, she reprimanded him. Lou, it was Passover season. I don't care if it was judgment, Trump, Lewis said with a sudden low and hoarse savagery that caused her to pull back a little. He was remembering the student nurses, those two candy stripers whose evil luck it had been to be in attendance on the morning Pascal had been brought in dying. One of them, a tough little lady named Carla Shavers, had returned the next day and had worked out so well that even Charlton was impressed. The other, they had never seen again. Lewis was not surprised and did not blame her. Where was the nurse? There should have been an RN in attendance. They went out. They actually went out and left an 8-year-old kid in charge of her dying sister, who was probably clinically insane by then. Why? Because it was Passover season. And because elegant Dory Goldman couldn't stand the stink that particular morning and had to get away from it for just a little while. So Rachel got the duty. Right, friends and neighbors? Rachel got the duty. 8 years old, pigtails, midi blouse. Rachel got the duty. Rachel could stay and put up with the stink. What did they send her to Camp Sunset in Vermont for 6 weeks every year, if not to put up with the stink of her dying insane sister? 10 new shirt and jumper combinations for Gage and 6 new dresses for Ellie. And I'll pay your way through medical school if you'll stay away from my daughter. But where was the overflowing checkbook when your daughter was dying of spinal meningitis and your other daughter was alone with her, you bastard? Where was the R-fucking-N? Lewis sat up, got out of bed. Where are you going? Rachel asked, alarmed. To get you a Valium. You know I don't. Tonight you do, he said. She took the pill and then told him the rest. Her voice remained calm throughout. The tranquilizer was doing its job. The next-door neighbor had retrieved 8-year-old Rachel from behind a tree where she was crouching and screaming, Zelda's dead, over and over. Rachel's nose had been bleeding. She had blood all over her. The same neighbor had called the ambulance, and then her parents. After getting Rachel's nosebleed stopped and calming her with a cup of hot tea and 2 aspirins, she was able to get the location of her parents out of her. They were visiting Mr. and Mrs. Cabron across town. Peter Cabron was an accountant in her father's business. By that evening, great changes had taken place in the Goldman household. Zelda was gone. Her room had been cleaned and fumigated. All of the furniture was gone. The room was a bare box. Later, much later, it had become Dory Goldman's sewing room. The first of the nightmares had come to Rachel that night, and when Rachel woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning, screaming for her mother, she had been horrified to discover that she could barely get out of bed. Her back was in agony. She had strained it, moving Zelda. In her spurt of adrenaline-powered strength, she had, after all, lifted Zelda with enough force to pull her own blouse apart. That she had strained herself trying to keep Zelda from choking was simple, obvious, elementary, my dear Watson. To everyone, that was, except Rachel herself. Rachel had been sure that this was Zelda's revenge from beyond the grave.
Zelda knew that Rachel was glad she was dead. Zelda knew that when Rachel burst from the house telling all and sundry, "Zelda's dead, Zelda's dead," at the top of her voice, she had been laughing, not screaming. Zelda knew she had been murdered, and so had given Rachel spinal meningitis. And soon Rachel's back would start to twist and change, and she too would have to lie in bed, slowly but surely turning into a monster, her hands hooking into claws. After a while, she would begin screaming with the pain, as Zelda had done. And then she would start wetting the bed, and finally she would choke to death on her own tongue. It was Zelda's revenge. No one could talk Rachel out of this belief, not her mother, her father, or Dr. Murray, who diagnosed a mild back sprain and then told Rachel brusquely, cruelly, some, Lewis, for instance, would have said, to stop behaving so badly. She ought to remember that her sister had just died, Dr. Murray told her. Her parents were prostrate with grief, and this was not the time for Rachel to make a childish play for attention. Only the slowly abating pain had been able to convince her that she was neither the victim of Zelda's supernatural vengeance nor God's just punishment of the wicked. For months, or so she told Lewis, it had actually been years, eight of them, afterward, she would awaken from nightmares in which her sister died over and over again, and in the dark, Rachel's hands would fly to her back to make sure it was all right. In the frightful aftermath of these dreams, she often thought the closet door would bang open and Zelda would lurch out blue and twisted, her eyes rolled up to shiny whites, her black tongue puffing out through her lips, her hands hooked into claws to murder the murderer, cowering in her bed with her hands jammed into the small of her back. She had not attended Zelda's funeral or any funeral since. "If you'd told me this before," Lewis said, "it would have explained a hell of a lot." "Lou, I couldn't," she said simply. She sounded very sleepy now. "Since then I've been, I guess, a little phobic on the subject." "Just a little phobic," Lewis thought. "Yeah, right. I can't seem to help it. In my mind, I know you're right, that death is perfectly natural, good even. But what my mind knows and what happens inside me..." "Yeah," he said. "That day I blew up at you," she said. "I knew that Ellie was just crying over the idea, a way of getting used to it. But I couldn't help it. I'm sorry, Lewis." "No apology needed," he said, stroking her hair. "But what the hell? I accept it anyway, if it'll make you feel better." She smiled. "It does, you know. And I feel better. I feel as if I just sicked up something that's poisoned part of me for years."
"Maybe you have."
Rachel's eyes slipped closed and then opened again, slowly. "And don't blame it all on my father, Lewis. Please. That was a terrible time for them. The bills, Zelda's bills, were sky high. My dad had missed his chance to expand into the suburbs, and the sales in the downtown store were off. On top of that, my mother was half crazy herself. Well, it all worked out. It was as if Zelda's death was the signal for good times to come around again. There had been a recession, but then the money loosened up and Daddy got his loan, and since then he's never looked back. But that's why they've always been possessive of me, I think. It's not just because I'm the only one left."
"It's guilt," Lewis said.
"Yes, I suppose. And you won't be mad at me if I'm sick when they bury Norma?"
"No, honey, I won't be mad."
He paused and then took her hand.
"May I take Ellie?"
Her hand tightened in his. "Oh, Lewis, I don't know," she said. "She's so young.
She's known where babies come from for a year or more," he reminded her again.
She was quiet for a long time, looking up at the ceiling and biting her lips. "If you think it's best," she said finally. "If you think it won't hurt her..."
"Come over here, Rachel," he said.
And that night they slept back to stomach in Lewis's bed. And when she woke up, trembling in the middle of the night, the Valium worn off, he soothed her with his hands and whispered in her ear that everything was okay, and she slept again. 33. For man and woman is like the flowers in the valley, which bloom today and are tomorrow cast into the oven. The time of man is but a season. It cometh, and so it passeth away. Let us pray. Ellie, resplendent in a navy blue dress, bought especially for the occasion, dropped her head so abruptly that Lewis, sitting next to her in the pew, heard her neck creak. Ellie had been in few churches, and of course it was her first funeral. The combination had awed her to unaccustomed silence. For Lewis, it had been a rare occasion with his daughter. Mostly blinded by his love for her, as he was by his love for Gage, he rarely observed her in a detached way. But today he thought he was seeing what was almost a textbook case of the child nearing the end of life's first great developmental stage. An organism of almost pure curiosity, storing up information madly in almost endless circuits. Ellie had been quiet even when Judd, looking strange but elegant in his black suit and lace-up shoes, Lewis believed it was the first time he'd ever seen him in anything but loafers or green rubber boots, had bent over, kissed her, and said, "Glad you could come, honey. And I bet Narma is, too." Ellie had gazed at him, wide-eyed. Now the Methodist minister, Reverend Laughlin, was pronouncing the benediction, asking God to lift up his countenance upon them and give them peace. "Will the pallbearers come forward?" he asked. Lewis started to rise, and Ellie halted him, tugging his arm frantically. She looked scared. "Daddy," she stage-whispered, "where are you going?" "I'm one of the pallbearers, honey," Lewis said, sitting down beside her again for a moment and putting an arm around her shoulders. "That means I'm going to help carry Norma out. There are four of us that are going to do it. Me and two of Judd's nephews and Norma's brother." "Where will I find you?" Lewis glanced down front. The other three pallbearers had assembled there, along with Judd. The rest of the congregation was filing out, some of them weeping. "If you just go out on the steps, I'll meet you there," he said. "All right, Ellie?" "Yes," she said. "Just don't forget me." "No, I won't." He got up again, and she tugged his hand again. "Daddy?"
"What, babe?"
"Don't drop her," Ellie whispered. Lewis joined the others, and Judd introduced him to the nephews, who were really second or third cousins, descendants of Judd's father's brother. They were big fellows in their 20s, with a strong facial resemblance. Norma's brother was somewhere in his late 50s, Lewis guessed, and while the strain of a death in the family was on his face, he seemed to be bearing up well. "Pleased to meet you all," Lewis said. He felt a trifle uncomfortable, an outsider in the family circle. They nodded at him. "Ellie okay?" Judd asked and nodded to her. She was lingering in the vestibule, watching. "Sure, she just wants to make sure I don't go up in a puff of smoke," Lewis thought, and almost smiled. But then that thought called up another one. "Oz the great and terrible." And the smile died. "Yes, I think so," Lewis said, and raised a hand to her. She raised hers in return and went outside then in a swirl of navy blue dress. For a moment, Lewis was uneasily struck by how adult she looked. It was the sort of illusion, no matter how fleeting, that could give a man pause. "You guys ready?" one of the nephews asked. Lewis nodded, so did Norma's younger brother. "Take it easy with her," Judd said. His voice had roughened. Then he turned away and walked slowly up the aisle with his head down. Lewis moved to the back left corner of the steel-gray American Eternal coffin Judd had chosen for his wife. He laid hold of his runner, and the four of them slowly carried Norma's coffin out into the bright, still cold of February 1st. Someone, the church custodian, he supposed, had laid down a good bed of cinders over the slippery path of tempered snow. At the curb, a Cadillac hearse idled white exhaust into the winter air. The funeral director and his husky son stood beside it, watching them, ready to lend a hand if anyone, her brother perhaps, should slip or flag. Judd stood beside him and watched as they slid the coffin inside. "Goodbye, Norma," he said and lit a cigarette. "I'll see you in a while, old girl." Lewis slipped an arm around Judd's shoulders, and Norma's brother stood close by on his other side, crowding the mortician and his son into the background.
The Brilli nephews, or second cousins, or whatever they were, had already done a fade, the simple job of lifting and carrying done. They had grown distant from this part of the family. They had known the woman's face from photographs and a few duty visits, perhaps. Long afternoons spent in the parlor eating Norma's cookies and drinking Judd's beer, perhaps not really minding the old stories of times they had not lived through and people they had not known, but aware of things they could have been doing all the same. The car that could have been washed and turtle-waxed, a league bowling practice, maybe just sitting around the TV and watching a boxing match with some friends, and glad to be away when the duty was done. Judd's part of the family was in the past now, as far as they were concerned. It was like an eroded planetoid drifting away from the main mass, dwindling, little more than a speck. The past. Pictures in an album. Old stories told in rooms that perhaps seemed too hot to them. They were not old. There was no arthritis in their joints. Their blood had not thinned. The past was runners to be gripped and hefted and later let go. After all, if the human body was an envelope to hold the human soul, God's letters to the universe, as most churches taught, then the American eternal coffin was an envelope to hold the human body. And to these husky young cousins or nephews or whatever they were, the past was just a dead letter to be filed away. God save the past, Lewis thought and shivered for no good reason other than that the day would come when he would be every bit unfamiliar to his own blood. His own grandchildren, if Ellie or Gage produced kids and he lived to see them. The focus shifted. Family lines degenerated. Young faces looking out of old photographs. God save the past, he thought again and tightened his grip around the old man's shoulders. The ushers put the flowers into the back of the hearse. The electric rear window rose and thumped home in its socket. Lewis went back to where his daughter was, and they walked to the station wagon together, Lewis holding Ellie's arm so she wouldn't slip in her good shoes with the leather soles. Car engines were starting up. "Where are they putting on their lights, Daddy?" Ellie asked with mild wonder. "Where are they putting on their lights in the middle of the day?" "They do it," Lewis began and heard the thickness in his own voice, "to honor the dead, Ellie." He pulled out the knob that turned on the wagon's headlights. "Come on." They were going home at last. The graveside ceremony over. Actually, it was held at the small Mount Hope Chapel. No grave would be dug for Norma until spring. When Ellie suddenly burst into tears. Lewis glanced at her, surprised but not particularly alarmed. "Ellie, what is it?" "No more cookies," Ellie sobbed. "She made the best oatmeal cookies I ever ate. But she won't make them anymore because she's dead. Daddy, why do people have to be dead?" "I don't really know," Lewis said. "To make room for all the new people, I guess. Little people like you and your brother Gage." "I'm never going to get married or do sex and have babies," Ellie declared, crying harder than ever. "Then maybe it'll never happen to me. It's awful. It's mean. "But it's an end to suffering," Lewis said quietly. "And as a doctor, I see a lot of suffering. One of the reasons I wanted the job at the university was because I got sick of looking at it day in and day out. Young people quite often have pain, bad pain even, but that's not quite the same as suffering." He paused. "Believe it or not, honey, when people get very old, death doesn't always look so bad or so scary as it seems to you. And you have years and years and years ahead of you." Ellie cried, and then she sniffed, and then she stopped. Before they got home, she asked if she could play the radio. Lewis said yes, and she found Shakin' Stevens singing "This Old House" on WACZ. Soon she was singing along. When they got home, she went to her mother and prattled about the funeral. To Rachel's credit, she listened quietly, sympathetically, and supportively, although Lewis thought she looked pale and thoughtful. Then Ellie asked her if she knew how to make oatmeal cookies, and Rachel put away the piece of knitting she'd been doing and rose at once, as if she had been waiting for this or something like it. "Yes," she said. "Want to make a batch?" "Yay!" Ellie shouted. "Can we really, Mom?" We can if your father will watch Gage for an hour.
I'll watch him, Lewis said. With pleasure.
Lewis spent the evening reading and making notes on a long article in the Duquesne Medical Digest. The old controversy concerning dissolving sutures had begun again. In the small world of those relatively few humans on Earth concerned with stitching minor wounds, it appeared to be as endless as that old psychological squabbling point, nature versus nurture. He intended writing a dissenting letter this very night, proving that the writer's main contentions were specious, his case examples self-serving, his research almost criminally sloppy. In short, Lewis was looking forward, with high good humor, to blowing the stupid fuck right off the map. He was hunting around in the study bookcase for his copy of Trotman's Treatment of Wounds when Rachel came halfway down the stairs.
Coming up, Lou?
I'll be a while. He glanced up at her. Everything all right?
They're deep asleep, both of them.
Lewis looked at her closely. Them, yeah. You're not.
I'm fine. Been reading.
You're okay? Really?
Yes, she said and smiled. I love you, Lewis.
Love you too, babe. He glanced at the bookcase, and there was Trotman, right where he had been all along. Lewis put his hand on the textbook.
Church brought a rat into the house while you and Ellie were gone, she said and tried to smile.
Yuck, what a mess.
Geez, Rachel, I'm sorry.
He hoped he did not sound as guilty as at that moment he felt.
It was bad?
Rachel sat down on the stairs, in her pink flannel nightgown, her face cleaned of makeup and her forehead shining, her hair tied back into a short ponytail with a rubber band. She looked like a child.
I took care of it, she said. But you know, I had to beat that dumb cat out the door with a vacuum cleaner attachment before it would stop guarding the corpse. It growled at me.
Church never growled at me before in his life.
He seems different lately. Do you think he might have distemper or something, Lewis?
No, Lewis said slowly. But I'll take him to the vet if you want.
I guess it's all right, she said, and then looked at him nakedly. But would you come up? I know you're working, but...
Of course, he said, getting up as though it were nothing important at all.
And really, it wasn't, except he knew that now the letter would never be written, because the parade has a way of moving on, and tomorrow would bring something new.
But he had bought that rat, hadn't he? The rat that Church had brought in, surely clawed to bloody ribbons, its intestines dragging, its head perhaps gone. Yes, he had bought it. It was his rat.
Let's go to bed, he said, turning off the lights.
He and Rachel went up the stairs together. Lewis put his arm around her waist and loved her the best he could. But even as he entered into her, hard and erect, he was listening to the winter whine outside the frost-traced windows, wondering about Church, the cat that used to belong to his daughter and now belonged to him, wondering where it was and what it was stalking or killing. The soil of a man's heart is stonier, he thought, and the wind sang its bitter black song. And not so many miles distant, Norma Crandall, who had once knitted his daughter in sun-matching caps, lay in her great steel American Eternal coffin on a stone slab in a Mount Hope crypt. By now, the white cotton the mortician would have used to stuff her cheeks would be turning black. 34. Ellie turned 6. She came home from kindergarten on her birthday with a paper hat askew on her head, several pictures friends had drawn of her, in the best of them Ellie looked like a friendly scarecrow, and baleful stories about spankings in the schoolyard during recess. The flu epidemic passed. They had to send 2 students to the EMMC in Bangor, and Surendra Hardu probably saved the life of one woefully sick freshman boy with a terrible name of Peter Humperton, who went into convulsions shortly after being admitted. Rachel developed a mild infatuation with the blonde bag boy at the A&P in Brewer, and rhapsodized to Lewis at night about how packed his jeans looked.
It's probably just toilet paper, she added.
Squeeze it sometime, Lewis suggested. If he screams, it's probably not. Rachel had laughed until she cried. The blue, still sub-zero mini-season of February passed and brought on the alternating rains and freezes of March, potholes, and those orange roadside signs which pay homage to the great god Bump. The immediate, personal, and most agonizing grief of Judd Crandall passed, that grief which the psychologists say begins about 3 days after the death of a loved one and holds hard from 4 to 6 weeks in most cases, like that period of time New Englanders sometimes call deep winter. But time passes, and time welds one state of human feelings into another until they become something like a rainbow. Strong grief becomes a softer, more mellow grief. Mellow grief becomes mourning. Mourning at last becomes remembrance, a process that may take from 6 months to 3 years and still be considered normal. The day of Gage's first haircut came and passed, and when Lewis saw his son's hair growing in darker, he joked about it and did his own mourning, but only in his heart. Spring came, and it stayed a while. 35. Lewis Creed came to believe that the last really happy day of his life was March 24, 1984. The things that were to come, poised above them like a killing sash weight, were still over 7 weeks in the future. But looking over those 7 weeks, he found nothing which stood out with the same color. He supposed that even if none of those terrible things had happened, he would have remembered the day forever. Days would seem genuinely good. Good all the way through are rare enough anyway, he thought. It might be that there was less than a month of really good ones in any natural man's life in the best of circumstances. It came to seem to Lewis that God, in his infinite wisdom, seemed much more generous when it came to doling out pain. That day was a Saturday, and he was home minding Gage in the afternoon while Rachel and Ellie went after groceries. He had gone with Judd in his old and rattling 59 IH pickup, not because the station wagon wasn't running, but because the old man genuinely liked their company. Rachel asked Lewis if he would be okay with Gage, and he told her that of course he would. He was glad to see her get out. After winter in Maine, most of it in Ludlow, he thought that she needed all the getting out she could lay her hands on. She'd been an unremittingly good sport about it, but she did seem to him to be getting a little stir-crazy. Gage got up from his nap around 2 o'clock, scratchy and out of sorts. He discovered the terrible twos and made them his own. Lewis tried several ineffectual gambits to amuse the kid, and Gage turned them all down. To make matters worse, the rotten kid had an enormous bowel movement, the artistic quality of which was not improved for Lewis when he saw a blue marble sitting in the middle of it. It was one of Ellie's marbles. The kid could have choked. He decided the marbles were going to go. Everything Gage got hold of went right to his mouth. But that decision, while undoubtedly laudable, didn't do a thing about keeping the kid amused until his mother got back. Lewis listened to the early spring wind gust around the house, sending big blinkers of light and shadow across Mrs. Vinton's field next door. And he suddenly thought of the vulture he had bought on a whim 5 or 6 weeks before, while on his way home from the university. Had he bought twine as well? He had, by God. Gage, he said. Gage had found a green Crayola under the couch and was currently scribbling in one of Ellie's favorite books. Something else to feed the fires of sibling rivalry, Lewis thought and grinned. If Ellie got really pissy about the scribbles Gage had managed to put in Where the Wild Things Are before Lewis could get it away from him, Lewis would simply mention the unique treasure he had uncovered in Gage's pampers. What? Gage responded smartly. He was talking pretty well now. Lewis had decided the kid might actually be half bright. You want to go out?
Want to go out?
Gage agreed excitedly.
Want to go out? Where are my neeks, Daddy?
This sentence, if reproduced phonetically, would have looked something like this. Where ma neeks, Daddy? The translation was, Where are my sneakers, father? Lewis was often struck by Gage's speech, not because it was cute, but because he thought that small children all sounded like immigrants learning a foreign language in some helter-skelter but fairly amiable way. He knew that babies make all the sounds the human voice box is capable of, the liquid trill that proves so difficult for first-year French students, the glottal grunts and clicks of the Australian bush people, the thickened, abrupt consonants of German. They lose the capability as they learn English, and Lewis wondered now, and not for the first time, if childhood was not more a period of forgetting than of learning. Gage's neeks were finally found. They were also under the couch. One of Lewis's other beliefs was that in families with small children, the area under living room couches begins after a while to develop a strong and mysterious electromagnetic force that eventually sucks in all sorts of litter. Everything from bottles and diaper pins to green Crayolas and old issues of Sesame Street magazine with food moldering between the pages. Gage's jacket, however, wasn't under the couch. It was halfway down the stairs. His Red Sox cap, without which Gage refused to leave the house, was the most difficult of all to find because it was where it belonged, in the closet. That was, naturally, the last place they looked. "Where going, Daddy?" Gage asked companionably, giving his father his hand. "Going over in Mrs. Vinton's field," he said. "Gonna go fly a kite, my man." "Kite?" Gage asked doubtfully. "You'll like it," Lewis said. "Wait a minute, kiddo." They're in the garage now. Lewis found his key ring, unlocked the little storage closet, and turned on the light. He rummaged through the closet and found the Vulture, still in its store bag with a sales slip stapled to it. He had bought it in the depths of mid-February, when his soul had cried out for some hope. "Dat?" Gage asked. This was Gagee's for, "Whatever in the world might you have there, father?" "It's the kite," Lewis said, and pulled it out of the bag. Gage watched, interested, as Lewis unfurled the Vulture, which spread its wings over perhaps 5 feet of tough plastic. Its bulgy, bloodshot eyes stared out at them from its small head atop its scrawny, pinkly, naked neck. "Bert!" Gage yelled. "Bert, Daddy! Got a Bert!" "Yeah, it's a bird," Lewis agreed, slipping the sticks into the pockets at the back of the kite and rummaging again for the 500 feet of kite twine that he had bought the same day. He looked back over his shoulder and repeated to Gage, "You're gonna like it, big guy." Gage liked it. They took the kite over into Mrs. Vinton's field, and Lewis got it up into the blowy late March sky first shot, although he had not flown a kite since he was, what, 12? 19 years ago? God, that was horrible. Mrs. Vinton was a woman of almost Judd's age, but immeasurably more frail. She lived in a brick house at the head of her field, but now she came out only rarely. Behind the house, the field ended and the woods began, the woods that led first to the pet cemetery and then to the Micmac burying ground beyond it. "Kite's flying, Daddy!" Gage screamed. "Yeah, look at it go!" Lewis bellowed back, laughing and excited. He paid out kite twine so fast that the string grew hot and branded thin fire across his palm. "Look at that Vulture, Gage. She's going to beat shit. Beat shit," Gage cried and laughed, high and joyously. The sun sailed out from behind a fat, gray spring cloud, and the temperature seemed to go up 5 degrees almost at once. They stood in the bright, unreliable warmth of March, straining to be April, in the high, dead grass of Mrs. Vinton's field. Above them, the Vulture soared up toward the blue, higher, its plastic wings spread taut against that steady current of air, still higher. And as he had done as a child, Lewis felt himself going up to it, going into it, staring down as the world took on its actual shape, the one cartographers must see in their dreams. Mrs. Vinton's field, as white and still as cobwebs following the retreat of the snow, not just a field now, but a large parallelogram bounded by rock walls on two of its sides, and then the road at the bottom, a straight black seam, and the river valley. The Vulture saw it all with its soaring, bloodshot eyes. It saw the river like a cool gray band of steel, chunks of ice still floating in it. On the other side, it saw Hampton, Newburgh, Winterport, with a ship at dock. Perhaps it saw the St. Regis Mill at Bucksport below its steaming fume of cloud, or even Land's End itself, where the Atlantic pounded the naked rock. "Look at her go, Gage!" Lewis yelled, laughing. Gage was leaning so far back he was in danger of toppling over. A huge grin covered his face. He was waving to the kite. Lewis got some slack and told Gage to hold out one of his hands. Gage did, not even looking around. He couldn't take his eyes from the kite, which swung and danced in the wind and raced its shadow back and forth across the field. Lewis wound kite string twice around Gage's hand, and now he did look down, comically amazed at the strong tug and pull.
What?
He said. You're flying it, Lewis said. You got the hammer, my man. It's your kite.
Gage flying it?
Gage said, as if asking not his father but himself for confirmation. He pulled the string experimentally. The kite nodded in the windy sky. Gage pulled the string harder. The kite swooped. Lewis and his son laughed together. Gage reached out his free hand, groping, and Lewis took it in his own. They stood together that way in the middle of Mrs. Vinton's field, looking up at the vulture. It was a moment with his son that Lewis never forgot. As he had gone up and into the kite as a child himself, he now found himself going into Gage, his son. He felt himself shrink until he was within Gage's tiny house, looking out of the windows that were his eyes, looking out at a world that was so huge and bright. The world for Mrs. Vinton's field was nearly as big as the Bonneville Salt Flats, where the kite soared miles above him, the string drumming in his fist like a live thing as the wind blew around him, tumbling his hair.
"Kite flying!"
Gage cried out to his father, and Lewis put his arm around Gage's shoulders and kissed the boy's cheek, in which the wind had bloomed a wild rose.
"I love you, Gage," he said.
It was between the two of them, and that was all right. And Gage, who now had less than 2 months to live, laughed shrilly and joyously.
"Kite flying! Kite flying, Daddy!"
They were still flying the kite when Rachel and Ellie came home. He and Gage had gotten it so high that they had nearly run out the string, and the face of the vulture had been lost. It was only a small black silhouette in the sky. Lewis was glad to see the two of them, and he roared with laughter when Ellie dropped the string momentarily and chased it through the grass, catching it just before the tumbling, unraveling cord tube gave up the last of its twine. But having them around also changed things a little. And he was not terribly sorry to go in when, 20 minutes later, Rachel said she believed Gage had had enough of the wind. She was afraid he would get a chill. So the kite was pulled back in, fighting for the sky at every turn of the twine, at last surrendering. Lewis tucked it, black wings, buggy, bloodshot eyes and all, under his arm, and imprisoned it in the storage closet again. That night, Gage ate an enormous supper of hot dogs and beans, and while Rachel was dressing him in his Dr. Denton's for bed, Lewis took Ellie aside and had a heart-to-heart talk with her about leaving her marbles around. Under other circumstances, he might have ended up shouting at her because Ellie could turn quite haughty, insulting even when accused of some mistake. It was only her way of dealing with criticism, but that did not keep it from infuriating Lewis when she laid it on too thick or when he was particularly tired. But this night the kite flying had left him in a fine mood, and Ellie was inclined to be reasonable. She agreed to be more careful and then went downstairs to watch TV until 8:30, a Saturday indulgence she treasured.
"Okay, that's out of the way, and it might even do some good," Lewis thought, not knowing that marbles were really not the problem,
and chills were really not the problem, that a large Orenco truck was going to be the problem, that the road was going to be the problem, as Judd Crandall had warned them it might be on that first day of August. He went upstairs that night about 15 minutes after Gage had been put to bed. He found his son quiet but still awake, drinking the last of a bottle of milk and looking contemplatively up at the ceiling. Lois took one of Gage's feet in one hand and raised it up. He kissed it, lowered it. "Good night, Gage," he said.
"Kite flying, Daddy," Gage said.
"It really did fly, didn't it?" Lewis said. And for no reason at all, he felt tears behind his eyes.
"Right up to the sky, my man."
"Kite flying," Gage said.
"Up to the sky."
He rolled over on his side, closed his eyes, and slept. Just like that. Lewis was stepping into the hall when he glanced back and saw yellowy-green disembodied eyes staring out at him from Gage's closet. The closet door was open, just a crack. His heart took a lurch into his throat, and his mouth pulled back and down in a grimace. He opened the closet door, thinking, "Zelda, it's Zelda, in the closet, her black tongue puffing out between her lips. He wasn't sure what, but of course it was only church. The cat was in the closet, and when it saw Lewis, it arched its back like a cat on a Halloween card. It hissed at him, its mouth partly open, revealing its needle-sharp teeth.
"Get out of there,"
Lewis whispered. Church hissed again. It did not move. "Get out," I said. He picked up the first thing that came to hand in the litter of Gage's toys, a bright plastic chuggy-chuggy-choo-choo, which in this dim light was the maroon color of dried blood. He brandished it at Church. The cat not only stood its ground, but hissed again. And suddenly, without even thinking, Lewis threw the toy at the cat, not playing, not goofing around. He pegged the toy at the cat as hard as he could, furious at it, and scared of it, too, that it should hide here in the darkened closet of his son's room and refuse to leave, as if it had a right to be there. The toy locomotive struck the cat dead center. Church uttered a squawk and fled, displaying its usual grace by slamming into the door and almost falling over on its way out. Gage stirred, muttered something, shifted position, and was still again. Lewis felt a little sick. There was sweat standing out in beads on his forehead.
Lewis?
Rachel from downstairs, sounding alarmed.
Did Gage fall out of his crib?
He's fine, honey. Church knocked over a couple of his toys.
Oh, all right.
He felt, irrationally or otherwise, the way he might have felt if he had looked in on his son and found a snake crawling over him or a big rat perched on the bookshelf over Gage's crib. Of course it was irrational. But when it had hissed at him from the closet like that... Did you think Oz the Great and Terrible? He closed Gage's closet door, sweeping a number of toys back in with its moving foot. He listened to the tiny click of the latch. After a moment's further hesitation, he turned the closet's thumb bolt. He went back to Gage's crib, and shifting around, the kid had kicked his two blankets down around his knees. Lewis disentangled him, pulled the blankets up, and then merely stood there, watching his son, for a long time.